Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the 2017 Economic Outlook Call with Benjamin Tal. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Jay Barrett, Executive Director, Renaissance Investments. Please go ahead, Mr. Barrett.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this afternoon's Economic Update Call with CIBC's Deputy Chief Economist, Mr. Benjamin Tal, titled Alternative Facts. Indeed, there has perhaps never been more of a collusion of social, political, and economic circumstances making today's discussion all the more relevant. From the humanitarian crisis in the Middle East and Europe to a controversial presidency south of the border and the trade implications of such for Canada and the rest of the world, to say that Mr. Tal's job is challenging these days would be nothing short of a gross underestimation. Benjamin Tal is responsible for analyzing economic developments and their implications for North American fixed income, equity, foreign exchange, and commodity markets. He also acts in an advisory capacity to bank officers on issues related to wealth management, household and corporate credit, and risk. Mr. Tal is a regular commentator on financial and economic trends in the Canadian and American media. If you would like to follow along with Mr. Tal's presentation, but do not have a copy in front of you, please go to renaissanceinvestments.ca and click on the What's New heading. I now cede the floor to Mr. Bentel.
Okay, thank you very much. I will try to cover most of the points. We don't have much time, only half an hour, and a lot to talk about. So let's start and see what happens. I predict that Trump will be a one-term president. The reason I predict that is that I really believe that 4 years from now, I simply will say, you know what, it's too much work, not for me. The other reason, I think, is that by 2018 or 19, you will see major fights with Congress. You will see a situation in which the honeymoon will be over, the fight will be over the debt level, we'll discuss it in a second, and that will be a major issue impacting his willingness and ability to win another elections. And the third reason, which is the most important one, is that I really believe that the problem that he is trying to solve, namely jobs, this problem simply does not have a solution. That's the elephant in the room. And if you refer to chart one, you can see what I'm talking about. You can see that the U.S. manufacturing jobs, you know, were declining and going down and down way before China entered the WTO. Then it continued to go down more or less at the same rate, and recently it's actually stabilizing, which means that maybe Trump is fighting yesterday's war. The issue is that for every job we lost to trade, we lost 8 to automation. So this is not about China. This is not about Mexico. This is not about Canada. Those jobs are not coming back. And those people in Michigan will be waiting for them 4 years from now, and they will not be there. That's another reason why I believe that he will not run for another mandate. So that's the background. Now, if you go to the next chart, you can see really what explains Trump. Clearly, the labor market in the U.S., the headline numbers are strong, but there's a significant portion of the labor market that is simply not part of the economic recovery. The participation rate, as you can see from the second chart, going down. Long-term unemployment, although went down recently, it's still elevated. In fact, today it is higher than it was during the peak of 2000 and, you know, the 1991 recession. So we have a situation in which the labor market at the margin is relatively weak at the margin. And those people who simply don't participate in the recovery, they have the right to vote. And that's Trump, that's Brexit, that's the labor market mismatch that we have to understand. If you go to the next chart, you can see what I'm talking about. We have a situation in which today there are more people in the U.S. that collect disability insurance than production workers. That's unheard of, but that's clearly a signal that something is not perfect in the labor market. To an extent, that explains Trump and even Brexit. I think it would be naive to believe that Canada is immune to this trend. So if you go to the next chart, Canada, share of low-paying jobs, rising. Basically, the quality of employment in Canada is going down, the number of low-paying jobs below average wage rising. Clearly, Canada is not immune to this trend. It's a global trend. not as extreme as in the U.S., but Canada clearly is not immune to that trend. So that's the background that I believe is important to understand when we discuss Trump and what he's going to do and what he's not going to do. That's the background. That's where the support is coming from. The mismatch in the labor market is a big thing, but at the same time, he will be very limited in his ability to actually deliver on many of the promises. We'll get into it in a second with a bit, you know, much more detail. So that's basically the background. Now, if you go to the next chart, surprise indexes, basically suggesting that the global economy that Trump is inheriting is actually okay. The global economy is recovering. 2017 is better than 2016. There is no question about it. Every indication suggests everything that we see, including manufacturing activity everywhere, is doing better. The Eurozone is surprising on the upside. So we have a cyclical recovery, but this cyclical recovery is really a mirage. Namely, it's a reflection of a lot of money that was injected into the system. We are all aware of the quantitative easing in the U.S. until recently. We know what's happening in Japan. Interest rates are negative and they're printing money. Same goes for the Eurozone. China until recently was cutting interest rates. So there is a lot of injection of money and liquidity into the system. There's a lot of wind. And if you generate enough wind, even pigs can fly. And that's exactly what we are seeing. But we have to remember, and again, going back to what's explaining Trump, is the next chart. This improvement is cyclical in a trajectory of actually a slowing global economy. And that's because of demographics, because of productivity, because of many, many other reasons that are basically there, and they are impacting the Eurozone, they are impacting the UK, clearly Canada, clearly the US, and even China. Even Trump cannot change that reality. This is a slowing trajectory. The potential growth of the global economy is going down, even in emerging markets and, of course, China. That's a demographic story that we simply cannot stop. Even Trump cannot do that. That's very, very important to understand as a background. Now let's go visit some of the pockets of uncertainty. One of them, of course, is the Eurozone. I've been shorting the euro for the past 6 months. The main reason is not economics. In fact, in some measures, the Eurozone economy is doing better than even the U.S. economy. But the political situation in the Eurozone is very, very tricky. We have three elections coming, the Netherlands, France, and of course the big one, Germany. And we have a situation in which the market is not sure about Angela Merkel winning. And of course we know what's happening in France. And that's always negative for the Eurozone, because never before have I seen a situation in which so much of the very stability or even existence of the euro depends on one person. This person is Angela Merkel. To the extent that the market is starting to tweet about the possibility of her losing the elections, that's enough to get nervous about the euro. I will be waiting until I get the green light from Germany. I think we will be getting that green light, and then I will actually will be longing the euro. Before that, I think the situation is a bit tricky. The euro is risky. Brexit, for now, It has been a buying opportunity. We discussed it in the past. Now we know what Theresa May wants, and she's going to get it. She's basically going to get an exit from the EU, but so far she has been losing in her negotiations with the EU. The EU has been negotiating in a very, very, hard way. Their tactic is basically to submit their position and they don't move. And they had to basically, forced the UK to initiate Article 50 before any negotiations. That's something that she wanted to avoid. Now she has 2 years to negotiate a trade deal with the EU, which is not easy to do. Never before they were able to negotiate a trade deal in such a short period of time. The timing of Brexit is terrible for the UK because under the umbrella of the EU, the UK maybe was able to fight Trump and actually have an argument here and basically some sort of power. without the umbrella of the EU, the UK needs the US more than ever. She wants to promote free trade. Trump is doing the opposite. So it's a very complicated situation that they are in. So clearly, with the EU, it will have been much easier. Now, it's much more complex. So therefore, I think that the situation in the UK, economically speaking, is fragile until we get more clarity on the exit. The exit is not going to be clean, and I think that the free trade agreement that they would like to see with the EU will not be as free as perceived. So that's the UK and the Eurozone. The next chart, China, I think that we are starting to see some improvement when it comes to consumer spending relative to investment. But as you can see from the chart to the right, we have seen a significant increase in credit in China now, 22% increase on a year-over-year basis. This is a reflection of the government panicking a little bit. They're seeing investment slowing down a little bit, and they would like to make sure that not too many people lose their jobs. So basically, they inject liquidity into the system. And 85% of this new money is going to real estate. And I think that all of us would agree that the last thing that China needs at this point is another empty shopping mall. So we have a situation which a lot of unproductive money is chasing all kinds of real estate that nobody needs. That's not really good, and that's why the IMF is very concerned about the rising level of debt. If you go to the next chart, you can see the story regarding China and the U.S. The dependency of China on the U.S. is not in the sky. In fact, it has been going down until recently, but still it's lower than it used to be a decade ago or so. And as you can see from the chart to the right, and the title is China's Export Dependence, you can see that Canada is 20% of our GDP is going to the U.S., Mexico 30%, China less than 5%. And now if Trump wants to isolate China and impose tariff, this number will go down from 4% to, let's say, 2%. The minute you reach such a low number, it means that the U.S. will become less and less important for China, and China will be able to start exercising its own, let's say, foreign policy with major implications for North Korea and other areas in the world. So this is complicated. It's much more than economics. And that's why I think you will see a situation which the trade policies will not be implemented as quickly as perceived. We'll discuss it in a second. So that's the story in China. China is basically spending a lot of money trying to stimulate investment. Clearly, this is something that is leading to some debt, and that's why I think that China is a bit vulnerable. But for now, for 2017 and even 2018, China will surprise on the upside because there's not enough money in the system to actually support the economy. But remember, in the background, they're building a lot of debt, and that's something that we have to take into account. Very, very quickly, let's discuss another issue, which is oil prices. As you can see in the next chart, the title is Shell Marginal Supplier, basically telling you that there are three supply curves in the oil market. There is the OPEC, the cheap one. You have the middle, which is U.S. production. And then we have us, which is the expensive one. And now, as you know, we're operating at between 50 and 55 bucks a barrel. That's exactly where U.S. production is more active. That's their zone. So you see supply starting to rise. The rig count is rising. There's more people drilling. So this will prevent prices from rising significantly, let's say over 60%, because now de facto Shell Oil, U.S. production, is basically the swing producer of the market. So they are able to increase supply at a relatively short period of time, and that will limit the ability of oil prices to climb over 60 where we reside. And that's why the impact on Canada is going to be only partial impact. We're not going to get the full benefit because we are more expensive. As you can see from the next chart, it means that, yes, investment will be rising in Canada, but it will be half of what it used to be. So you won't see major employment, you won't see major spending, you'll see more production, and therefore the bottom line will improve, but you will not see significant investment because CEOs in Alberta, what they need is elevated prices, when it's elevated, north of 60, and stable prices. And I don't see it happening. So that's why Alberta is still in the fourth, fifth inning of this story, which is maybe a good thing because it's really forcing Alberta to diversify. So what to do with energy. I'm actually longing energy. I'm longing energy in the U.S., more in Canada, because in the U.S., everything is working for them. You have a situation in which you have less regulations. Clearly, alternative energy is not a factor, and they are not paying for carbon at this point. They will be receiving the tax cuts. So I suggest that energy in the U.S. will do fine. The question is, what will happen to Canada? That's the big story, because we can benefit from everything, including the increased momentum and higher prices. Clearly, we will not be getting the same lift because our cost structure is higher, but it's enough to actually show nice profit. So I'm okay with Canadian energy. The big, big story, of course, is taxes. To what extent Trump will implement what we call the border adjusted tax, which is a major issue. If he's imposing it on energy as well, then we have an issue. I don't think it will happen. I will discuss it in a second when I discuss trade. I really don't think it will happen. So if I have to gamble on that, I will say clearly the U.S. energy sector is fine. Even the Canadian energy sector, which I think is a bit more attractive now, is fine, assuming you won't see the tax. So I think that the market now is speculating about the possibility of a tax, and that's why valuations have been going down. It might be a buying opportunity if you have the time to do so. Clearly, the next chart, not exactly green. I'm not longing alternative energy. When you have a president that is not believing in global warming, and you have a situation which valuations already went down immediately after the elections, I doubt that those valuations will improve anytime soon. I don't see anything in his policy that is going to actually change that in any significant way. So valuations here will actually remain subdued. So I'm not longing alternative by any stretch of the imagination. Now let's go and discuss Trump quickly. The next chart, and the next chart is basically telling you why he has been signing all those executive orders at the speed of light, simply because of the fact that they are easy. Killing TPP is easy because TPP was there to start with. Even infrastructure is relatively easy. Deregulation, not difficult to do, although it's not final that they can actually pass it through Senate, but let's assume that he will do it. It's not difficult to do. Energy also, as I suggested, he can do that and nobody can stop him. And he believes that that's the right way to do. Keystone, relatively easy. Even the personal tax cuts and corporate tax cuts, fine. That's easy. And of course, the cash repatriation story, not difficult to implement. Even building a wall is not difficult. What's difficult is trade. Trade is difficult. And that's where I believe his pen will run out of ink. That's when he will stop signing, because trade is difficult. So let me discuss a few alternative facts, and then we'll discuss trade. First of all, the lift that the economy is going to get. Clearly, in 2017, and mostly in 2018, you will see a lift for the economy from Trump's policy, because it's basically spending money on infrastructure and cutting taxes. That's a good thing. But let's put it in perspective. Let's look at the chart. The title is The Infrastructure Bonanza. And you can see that according to their numbers, over the next 4 years, the infrastructure spending will create 50,000 jobs a year. 50,000 jobs a year. In an economy that generates 2.5 million jobs a year, 50,000 jobs is a rounding error. It's nothing. So clearly, you don't get this huge boom from infrastructure, especially in the labor market. So that's one alternative fact, if you wish, that suggests that the economy will not be rising as quickly as perceived. Another reason is the next chart. 70% of the tax cuts that is going to provide, 70% is going to the top 10%. This means that most of this money will be saved. It will not be spent. And therefore, the ability of the tax cut to lift the economy is limited, because it will be going to people with a relatively low propensity to consume. Even the cash repatriation story, the next chart, you know, when they are going to provide basically tax holiday or 10% tax on companies like Apple bringing back their money, we're talking about $2.3 trillion. So this money can go potentially to investment, but we know it's not going to happen, because in 2004, President Bush did the exact same thing, and we know that money did come back, but most of it went to buyback activity and raising dividends, a little went to investment, very little went to investment in employment. So again, you will not get the multiplier aspect from the economy. So that's another reason why you will not see the lift. And another reason is, that's the next picture, if you wish, is that Trump is not really Reagan. Many people compare Trump to Reagan because both of them believe that they can stimulate the economy. The difference is that Reagan started his activity when the economy was recessionary, when interest rates were going down, not up, and when the debt-to-GDP ratio was 30%. Trump is starting when the economy is basically at full potential, when interest rates are rising, and when the debt-to-GDP ratio is already 100%. What it means that if you start stimulating the economy at this level of activity, you are inflationary. Every aspect of Trump is inflationary. Everything that he's going to do is inflationary. And therefore, I believe that the correction in the bond market is sustainable. The correction in the bond market is sustainable, A, because of inflation and inflation expectations, and I think that inflation will rise because of that, because Trump is inflationary. Everything that he's doing is inflationary, especially given when he's starting from, or where he's starting from, which is a relatively elevated level of activity. The other reason why I believe that you will see interest rates remaining elevated or even going higher is because of the fact that he simply cannot pay for all the changes and the tax cuts and other things. He simply doesn't have the money. He will have to borrow. The debt level will start rising. That will put the pressure on the long end of the curve. Another reason why I think that the adjustment in the bond market is sustainable, and that's, by the way, where you will see the fight with Congress, because Congress will be fighting in a big, big way. So that's something that we have to take into account. Clearly not bullish for the bond market. I think that when it comes to trade, that's the most difficult part. I think that the alternative facts regarding trade are simply too significant, and I think that soon he will realize that the cure is worse than the disease. The negative impact will be significant. First of all, they're talking about the possibility of border-adjusted tax. This is a very difficult tax. This is 20% tax on basically imports, and that will be significant for Canada if they implement that. Remember that a VAT, border adjustment tax, is illegal under the WTO. A VAT, value-added tax, is legal, like we have it and others have it. By the way, the U.S. is the only country that does not have a value-added tax. But they, in the blueprint, they are basically saying this is not a VAT. This is a BAT, a B instead of a V. Because nobody in the U.S. will agree to go with a value-added tax, with a sales tax. But clearly, border-adjusted tax is something that they can justify, but it's illegal. If you do that, you allow Canada, Mexico, China, and others to retaliate. You have a trade war. And when you have a trade war, nobody's winning. And he knows that. His advisors know that. So I think that the likelihood of a border-adjusted tax is relatively low, although it's clearly a risk, especially for Canada. Another very important story regarding trade, that if you impose a tariff, that's the next chart, the tax equivalent tariff. And this is basically today how much people pay on tariff by income. And you can see that the bottom 10% is paying the most in terms of income. This is today. Now, if you increase tariff, let's say, to 45%, that's huge in terms of actual de facto tax on poor people. And remember, that those poor people are not getting the tax cuts. The top 10% are getting it, and they will be actually taxed vis-a-vis the tariff because of their propensity to consume, because they are the people who are buying in those low-cost centers that import a lot of the stuff. So you can see that Trump, by doing so, will be hurting the people who actually voted for him, and that's something that is going to be significant. Another alternative fact here is the fact that we have a situation in which the U.S. needs Mexico. They need Canada and they need China for many, many reasons. Their auto industry is starting to be linked more and more to the demand in China. We know that we have a huge generation of young Chinese consumers that want to see American products, brand names, value-added products. And this is the growth segment of the market. This is where the market is rising. The fastest growing segment of the global economy is the consumer of emerging markets. You start a trade war, you lose this potential growth, because I think the U.S. or the future of U.S. manufacturing is really the consumer of emerging markets. So a trade war here will basically limit their ability to grow, with major implications for jobs. Another point, very, very important, is that that's the next chart about the Mexican peso. It's already down by 15% after the elections, which means that Trump has to run faster in order to stay the same place. Basically, Mexico is already 15% cheaper. So if you impose a 30% tariff, it's like really imposing only a 15% tariff because of the decline in the value of the peso. So this strong American dollar, in many ways, Trump is actually hurting the trade position at this point. So that's very interesting. So as you can see, there are many alternative facts. To me, this suggests that they would think twice before they actually sign on any changes to trade regulations, including NAFTA. We'll talk about NAFTA now, and let's go to Canada. As you know, Canada was unable to take advantage of a very low dollar. The dollar went down from parity to 75 cents, unable to take advantage of that because of many reasons, as we indicated in previous discussions. During the dark days of parity, we lost 10% of capacity in manufacturing. Now we won't, but we can. We have to rebuild that capacity. Also, 70% of what we are selling to the U.S. is going to the manufacturing sector in the U.S., and the U.S. manufacturing sector is slowing down because of the strong American dollar, as I suggested earlier, and that's why they're not buying what we need. So this is another factor that is really limiting our ability. We are starting to see some improvement in manufacturing in Canada, but clearly we have a central bank that will keep interest rates low. A central bank that will keep interest rates low, and therefore you will have the risk of the Fed moving by three times, maybe this year, maybe twice, and the Bank of Canada doing nothing, despite the fact that inflation will be 2-2.5%, the Bank of Canada will tolerate that. So that's something that we are banking on, that the Bank of Canada will not move despite higher inflation, and we will see a situation which the dollar might lose 1 or 2 cents. The dollar is already elevated. I think it's too elevated. So if I have to bet where it will go over the next 6 to 8 months when the Fed is moving, my money is on somewhat weaker Canadian dollar. I think it's overshooting. Another one of the reasons why I'm investing in infrastructure is the next chart, is because if monetary policy is doing nothing and, in fact, unable to lift the economy, you need fiscal policy to compensate for that. And that's where I see infrastructure as a big winner, and that's why I'm investing in infrastructure, because everywhere in the global economy, infrastructure, namely fiscal policy, is replacing monetary policy. So you have the U.S., you have the Eurozone, Japan, and clearly Canada, basically spending on infrastructure. As you can see from this chart, the last chart, Canada is willing to spend on infrastructure. The money is there. We haven't found the projects yet, so that will be a 2018 story. So to sum up, what it means, all this means that, first of all, from an economic perspective, I believe that in 2017, and even to an extent in 2018, the U.S. will outperform Canada in terms of GDP growth, simply reflecting the impact of the positive movement in the U.S., although the multiplier effect there will not be as significant as alternatively, under alternative scenario, but it's still going to be positive. The sign will be positive. So you will get some push from lower taxes and infrastructure spending. That will be a positive. There will be an element of uncertainty impacting Canada, because although you will say 80% probability that it will not move on the tax, a border tax, there's 20% probability that it will move. And that's a negative for CEOs and investment. NAFTA will be renegotiated. That's something that will impact Canada. The uncertainty regarding NAFTA, another reason not to invest in Canada, and that's why I see Canada, again, underperforming when it comes to overall growth. Bottom line regarding NAFTA, very, very quickly, is that regardless what you do, if you renegotiate NAFTA or if you kill it and revive the free trade agreement, in both cases, the result, I believe, over time will be the same, namely the U.S. will be better off. Clearly, Canada at the margin will be worse off at the margin, especially when it comes to lumber, when it comes to dairy, when it comes to beef. Mexico, under any scenario, will be suffering and worse off. So that's NAFTA, the way I see it. So the starting point, I think that Canada will underperform the U.S. just because of the fact that the U.S. will get a better lift and the uncertainty regarding Canada. So I see them at, let's say, at 2.5%. Canada probably will be around 2%. So not a disaster, but nothing to write home about. Clearly, he's not going to get the 4% GDP growth that he needs in order to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio, and that's when I see problems with Congress starting. From an equity market perspective, first of all, stocks versus bonds. As I said, I believe that the correction in the bond market is sustainable. I think that Trump is inflationary. Increased inflation expectations can actually lead to even higher rates. The Fed will be moving to slow down Trump. So to me, this means that the bond market is not extremely inviting. I think that the stock market is more inviting. I'm totally aware of the fact that the stock market is expensive, especially in the U.S. I think that most of the activity was actually stolen by 2016, and therefore I don't see major movement in the index in 2017. But if I have to compare Canada to the U.S., I would say that at the margin, Canada probably will underperform the U.S. when it comes to the index itself, again, reflecting the uncertainty regarding the Canadian economy, NAFTA, and the tax. I think within this context, I will look at subsectors. I like energy, as I mentioned, in the U.S. more than Canada. But in Canada, if you believe that they will not go with the tax, which I think is a very reasonable assumption, it's possible that the market is a bit overreacting now, and there are some interesting opportunities even in Canada. I think that the infrastructure, it's a crowded trade, but if you can find a nice global index that follows infrastructure, I really like infrastructure from a long-term perspective, and it pays well. I think that the insurance companies will do well in this environment because interest rates will be rising in the U.S., so I like U.S. insurers, and to an extent that the 5-year rate in Canada and the 10-year rate will move a little bit higher, we will have a steeper yield curve, again, positive for financials and mostly insurers. What about gold? I think that we should have some gold in our portfolio. Gold is a very good protection against Trump. If he's inflationary, gold will be there. If something bad happens in terms of trade, gold will be there. So I think that gold is relatively good insurance, and we have seen gold starting to move in the right direction when the market is starting to starting to think twice about Trump. So I suggest we'll see it a bit more, especially when it comes to the time that he will have to fight Congress. We are late in the cycle, so always we are seeing M&A activity. In this sense, I like this space, especially places like the media space. Even energy, you will see some nice M&A activity. I like the consumer in the U.S., but only consumer discretionary, because I do believe that this segment of the market is going to show some improvement, reflecting the limited tax cuts that they will be getting, improved consumer confidence, and relatively strong labor market. So I like this space. I will not go with staples. I will go with this segment of the market simply because of the fact that it's more a link to the cycle. So that's the way I see it. So there are many ways to trade this market. I do believe that the stock market in 2017 will not be very strong because most of the activity was stolen. But within this context, the U.S. probably will underperform Canada, and within that, I see some segments that can outperform. That's the way I see the situation. A lot to digest, a lot, what if it can surprise the market, but I think that there's some logic to this madness, and I think that with time you will see that it's very limited in his ability to implement some of those policies, and the market will start realizing that. So I will have to end here. Thank you for your attention, and as probably will be indicated, any questions can be submitted via email. I will be more than happy to address them. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Ben, for your insightful discussion. For those of us who have had the chance to follow your work in years past, we've been well served. I have no doubt that today's perspective will serve us just as well. It certainly looks like market pundits have their work cut out for them over the course of the foreseeable future, yet, as is often the case, despite the pronounced turmoil, exists pronounced opportunity. A reminder to all of our guests looking to take advantage of opportunities south of the border while protecting against downside risk that the Renaissance U.S. Equity Fund is experiencing record asset flows. The fund is well known for its 5-star Morningstar rating, posting a return of better than 15% during 2016. It's also well known for mitigating adversity with its 20% position in convertible debentures, and perpetually trading on strength and weakness within a semi-static list of just 30 to 40 listed companies. I'll also remind our audience of our Renaissance Global Infrastructure Fund. It is, in fact, the largest infrastructure fund in Canada by AUM. It is the most prolific fund in this particular asset class, and it's actually one of the longest running funds within the infrastructure arena. As Ben mentioned, due to time constraints, we ask that you send any questions you might have for Ben to your Renaissance Investments representative, and we'll do our best to get back to you within a short delay. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank all of you for having invested of your time and attention this afternoon. On behalf of Renaissance Investments, my name is Jay Barrett. I wish you a pleasant remainder of the week and an even better year. Thank you very much for your time.